if you're a fan of this podcast, I'm going to put this at the beginning. This is what I do nowadays. You want to tune into the Parrot Room to find out about the psychiatrist who spoke to at Yale about her fantasies of shooting white people and how we as cuck commies are going to try to defend her or not. You'll find out in the Parrot Room. This is Pop the Left with Derek Varn and, of course, me, Douglas Lane. And we're going to be talking about the an essay by Paul Maddock, who I've been interested in lately. He wrote a book called he wrote an essay, I guess, called James Burnham's The Modern Machiavellians. And it's a book review, really, of Burnham's book, The Modern Machiavellians. So, yeah, I want you to start as to why you think we should be discussing this or why it's worth considering. For me, reading this book review was easy, too easy, because it was just like my feelings about Burnham having read the managerial book. What was it? What's the name of that one?
The Managerial Revolution.
Yeah, The Managerial Revolution. Having read that, my feelings about Burnham were that he had the a non-Marxist conception of how society functioned through elite power, essentially. And that is, in a sentence, what Maddock is saying about the modern Machiavellians. But, you know, that it takes more than a sentence to really critique someone like James Burnham.
James Burnham is a key figure in both the neoconservative and the paleoconservative movement. I read him as a paleoconservative in my early 20s. Mm-hmm. But his class theories don't go away. There's parallels to it across the political spectrum from the same time period. And they've been these have been recapitulated recently. Most notably in the work of John and Barbara Ehrenreich in the 80s, although they were trying to do something differently with this PMC thesis than what is currently being done. They were basically trying to align Burnham's thesis back with Marxism as an epiphenomenon of education. Now, this is kind of a weird reading of Burnham, actually, because Burnham's elites are more generic than that. And if you read The Modern Machiavellians, the whole book, which I did last year read it for a third time in my life, because I hadn't reread it as a Marxist. And I was struck by how transparent certain things are.
Well, let me ask you a question real quick. Back to Barbara Ehrenreich. And mm-hmm. their use of PMC. How different was that from something like the theory of a labor aristocracy?
It was a little different because they thought that the PMC was actually downwardly mobile. So what John and Barbara Ehrenreich in my mind were trying to do was trying to take those theories of the new left, of the student revolutionary subject replacing the workers after the 60s, and reconcile it a little bit with classical Marxism, although they kind of fail in that regard entirely, and then with other theories of elite movement. And so they went back to the managerial theories of the 40s, which there's Pollock's administrative class that comes up in the Frankfurt School. There's James Burnham's managerial class and from the Managerial Revolution and the Mind of Machiavellians, it's key to both books. And there's an Italian form of this too, I by two anarchists whose name just went out my head. And there was all these Maoist redefinitions of class coming out in America in the 60s. And so it looked like John and Barbara Ehrenreich were from the 80s trying to describe what happened to that student revolutionary thing, but they saw them as downwardly mobile, as probably willing to align with proletarian interests over time. But they didn't really define the class very well. I actually find Burnham's elite theory to be, even though I disagree with it, like more coherent than the PMC thesis, because Burnham's elite theory is basically Pareto's and Mosca's elite theory. And that is that there's a certain function of every field that has enough opportunity capture, become like a micro class within a class. And according to Burnham, they run all of society, kind of as a loose coalitions of different kinds of elites. And so there's governing elites and non-governing elites, etc. And he gets most of these distinctions from Pareto, some from Robert Michel. But there's a tell. And two, you know, people that are going to be well-known to the left caught the tell in this book, The Modern Machiavellians. Paul Maddock did, and George Orwell did. And Maddock does a better analysis than Orwell, but Orwell called it too. And that is, James Burnham has a soft spot for all the intellectual founders of the Italian fascist movement. Mm-hmm. And he makes two sets of predictions. And I think Orwell in his second thoughts on James Burnham goes into this probably more than Maddock. One prediction that he makes in the managerial revolution is that the Axis powers are going to win the war because they have the best form of management, better than the weird hybrid bourgeois management in America, and better than the Soviet managerials from proletarian origins in the USSR. He's of course wrong about that. And then in the end of The Modern Machiavellians, he predicts that the elites from the military, not the educational establishment, were actually going to run America forever. And that acknowledging this and working within this would lead to increased liberty and prosperity, unquote. So basically he thought that Eisenhower in his first year was going to be the perpetual rule of the United States. It's important to know also that not long after this, James Burnham goes into the OSS. He's recruited by George Kennan directly. And he worked as a anti-communist agent. A lot. So he was involved with the Congress for Cultural Freedom in the 1950s, and which was basically a bunch of ex-Marxists who were used to kind of do backdoor Cold War warrior stuff while appearing to be liberal in Western Europe. A lot of former people from Partisan Review was around, and Burnham was like the most right wing of that, and he was working undercover at the time.
Well, you said something earlier about opportunity capture. Mm-hmm. Remind me what opportunity capture is. It sounds like a term of art. So,
opportunity capture is when you from intra instead of inter class competition can hoard enough resources and social power to shut people out of your opportunity within the class move. So it can also be between classes, but it's given between classes. It's more significant sociologically to study within the same class itself.
So would opportunity capture, like in the realm of online influencers, be this idea that there's going to be a small group who, let's say, get in early in terms of creating websites and getting a following, and therefore because of that, the algorithm will follow them and it will set up an elite, even though it's not a merit-based capture of power.
That's exactly it.
Why is that particularly important? I mean, wouldn't it actually be better for the elites if it was a meritocratic system in terms of the efficiency of their rule? Wouldn't that give them more longevity?
They're not. You're assuming that the elites want efficiency for the system. And Burnham and Pareto assume that elites want power for themselves and nothing else.
Efficient, I don't even mean efficient for everyone. I just mean more effective, more competent.
They don't care about competency. They care about power capture.
Yeah, but like, even in terms of power capture. You know what I mean?
What I would say is historically speaking, there's little evidence that people actually give a shit about competence.
Even if you're like, just all you're talking about is the art of persuasion, mm-hmm. and manipulation. There are competent ways of doing that, and there are incompetent ways of doing that. There are ways to manipulate people that work, and there are incompetent ways. So if you have opportunity capture going on, and you're trying to get the elites to read Machiavelli, then they may not be capable of reading Machiavelli, and not particularly good at manipulating the masses or the lower stations in their own class or what have you.
Well, this actually, some people have actually noted that. So the Cleodynamics thinker Peter Turchin actually talks about this as a generational cycle, where you have opportunity capture, and then within two generations you have degradation, and then another group comes up and takes opportunity from those prior elites. And actually, Pareto writes a little bit about that himself. He sees this as like a natural pattern, but he sees it as a eternal pattern, like a pattern that can be found in all times throughout history. Modern people who talk about this will appeal to the Arabic proto-sociologist Ibn Khaldun as the first, you know, he's literally the founder of that stupid meme you see, like, hard times create good men create easy times, easy times create hard, create soft men. Soft men create hard times. It is that.
Do you need opportunity capture in order to explain why there's a concentration of power into a few hands at the top? Is that what that's there for?
Well, yeah, but what I find interesting about this is Burnham and co. posit this as a new class, as a way that you could run society. But when you actually look at objective sociology on opportunity capture, and there's Marxist sociology on this too, what you see is it's actually more intense between subgradients of people who are close together and within the same class. So you don't really see a lot of opportunity hoarding between like the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat, because there's no reason for it. They already have everything anyway. There's no opportunity to capture. Like they have every structural advantage. So what's weird about these Burnham PMC theories is they literally posit that somehow all of society is run by the middle of their class spectrum, by the upper middle. So there's elites, but the like real super elites are like gods in this spectrum. They're removed from the picture. So that's why they don't ever talk about the bourgeois. They figured like, oh, they're just all rich and not participating more. They don't care what happens.
In the managerial revolution, Burnham talks about the capitalist class as having been outflanked by these new managerial types and made irrelevant by the state and the powers that have accrued to the managers.
Well, so, basically, Burnham has an undialectical view. And when I say that, I'm not just throwing around Marxist jargon here. He literally left the SWP, and his long revoke lever to Trotsky is a specific rejection of dialectics as a methodology. So that's his first real differentiation from the left, is this long letter he wrote to Trotsky, I believe in 1937. It may have even been before that, saying that he rejects Marxism and he rejects socialism because he rejects dialectics, and he wants a different, more pluralistic system that incorporates culture and all that. I think there's obvious problems with this theory. One is the idea that there is this middle class that outflanked the bourgeoisie while being utterly dependent on them still is weird, because Burnham seems to think that private enterprise should have been monopoly capital directly into the government and gone away by the 30s. Now, there are a lot of people who were looking at monopoly capital projections. We've talked about this in terms of Hilferding. We've talked about this in terms of the Frankfurt School. We talked about this in terms of Paul Sweezy, who thought this might happen. It's not like the capitalist outflanking the Ancien regimes, because the capitalists are not dependent on the Ancien regimes. The Ancien regimes are actually standing in the way through their heavy rentier and vassalage schemes, right? They're standing in the way of the capitalists entirely. Well, the managerial class is still, if it is, even as a class, even if you accept that it's a class, which we could talk about why it doesn't, it's not clear, but let's say that it is. It's still utterly dependent on the bourgeois development and bourgeois class production. They don't own the production. They're only given rights to management in lieu of either the state or the need for, you know, efficient, skilled work. So it's like, if we were to put this in classical Marxist terms, you would be saying that somehow the labor aristocracy, without abolishing the bourgeoisie, somehow took all the political power from them and runs all of society while the bourgeoisie still exists unexpropriated.
Right.
So it's hard to see how someone could be that much in charge while still be in utter dependence on the thing that they're supposedly replacing.
Yeah, but Burnham in the managerial revolution doesn't seem to have much of a theory of capitalism in any case, right?
No.
He's not really thinking about the material production of the world in that book.
He's thinking about rather it's power. All politics. It's all political power, but it's not political power. Like, what that political power is based on is completely unclear. Like, even like the social relations and relations of production, because from this it sounds like that there's no material incentives other than power itself that would be propelling any of these people in these classes to act. It's basically, it's like if you assume Nietzsche's Real to Power made a class theory about it, put the upper middle in charge, and this said, thus it is so, and moved on. And the other thing about the managerials is when we think of PMC, we always think of educated people. But the managerials are not formally educated. This is not a credentialing or a cartelizing regime. What the managerials are people with just the technical skills for whatever reason. In both the case of the fascist and in the case of the U.S. military, which Burnham sees as our managerial elite that we should welcome, actually. Those are not educated through, you know, massive credentialized education. Yes, they might have some credentialized education, but we're talking in the 40s, that's not required. You know, he sees it as people who've been trained in technical skills through their work or through their position in the government or through credentialing or through whatever else that have created who have captured the ability to spread that knowledge and thus roll over it bureaucratically. Now, I mean, there is a weak sense in which some of the modern world is explained this way. I mean, superficially, this is pretty immediately compelling. When I was in my 20s, it was kind of compelling to me because, yeah, I didn't know who owned the business. I dealt with management. They dominated my life. I didn't know who was exploiting me, really. You know, it was so far removed from me. But when you start looking at the way, like, the economy works, for example, just in objective liberal sociology, what is the biggest decider of political policies? It's not what the management thinks. It's not what the professional political advisors think. It's who's paying the lobbyist who gets this stuff through. Study after study after study shows that. So the other thing that you get from this is all of these arguments, if you actually look at the arguments presented in both the managerial revolution and in the modern Machiavellians, Burnham doesn't actually offer a lot of empirical evidence for this. It's mostly based off of logical inference off of other descriptions. And there is some math involved, like Pareto's law, power law is involved. And there's also a refusal to put any one system as the dominant or preeminent, our first and foremost system. So in like in Pareto, there's like five different systems that are all considered equal. So social power, geographic influence, production is one of them. Like, but it's just one of them. And they're not even necessarily explored as having clear relationships to one another. It's just kind of implied. And in Burnham, you don't even get that. So what I find fascinating about our current moment is during this, I've been referring it now as the Great Burnout, but during this period, we see this resurrection and really a lot of people taking these right-wing class theories, trying to mesh them up with like ad hoc class theories we thought we saw in the 60s and add them back together. And you know, the last time we saw that, after the New Left, and the time we saw that before then was the failure of the left in the 20s. Like every time you have a left failure, you start seeing these new class theories come up, but they're vague. They're usually multivariant, meaning you can't figure out exactly what the defining parameter is for the class theory. I mean, we've gone through several PMC theories. Some of them are more coherent than others, but the most popular ones, you don't really know exactly who they're talking about. And it actually seems to move around semantically. Mm-hmm. In fact, today I did this vicious abstraction video for Theorizing with a Hammer. And I was literally thinking about the way people use PMC because they use it in a way where, like, you don't really know. You think you know what you're referring to. You, like, colloquially know who they're referring to. But when you actually go to define it, you don't really know who they're referring to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I'm interested in this idea that this is becoming popular during the burnout, as you put it, after Bernie Sanders. The only objection I might have to that explanation as to why it's popular right now is that it seems to me that at the theories of class that we had 5 years ago were not markedly different than the kinds of theories of class or ideas around class that allow one to be susceptible to mistaking Burnham for somehow a left thinker.
Right. I mean, I think I've seen people imply that Burnham is an ex-Marxist and a left-wing thinker, which literally excludes most of his life from that categorization.
I mean, he is an ex-Marxist.
He is an ex-Marxist. He's an ex-left-winger. Yeah. He founded the National Review and was a CIA's point man to William Buckley. I mean, like, come on.
Yeah. Obviously the books that, like, if you want to, I haven't read everything by Burnham. Maybe he wrote something when he was a Marxist that was actually Marxist. But if you're looking to these books where he's breaking from the left and from Marx as left-wing theory, you're clearly making a mistake. And if you know a little bit about Marx and class analysis from that perspective, you'll see it in these books and you'll see it in today's discourse. But nonetheless, I just put out this video, a week ago on Bernie Sanders and this moment after Bernie Sanders, where I tried to walk through the history of at least the relatively current history of left failure, starting, let's say, with the collapse of the Soviet Union into the WTO protests, into the World Social Forum. I kind of mentioned Occupy, which I probably should have mentioned more, but then into the Sanders campaign. And there's a lot of continuity in each one of those moments. There's continuity of an abandonment of old Marxist conceptions of working class power. But when I say that, I don't mean, if only people would have held more fast to that conception, they would have been successful, because there was a reason that conception fell away. Right. There's that continuity. There's an emphasis on either political power or simply cultural force, like in the World Social Forum, the attitudes of the individuals are what are thought to be a kind of power that could overcome corporate institutions and states, right? But overall, I see a lot of continuity between each form of the failure, even as some of the tactics change. Like, you know, let's stand outside of the institutions of power and try to organize a mass, which are defined as kind of fragmented and atomized, and are not only defined that way, but through our charters, there's an enforcement of atomization. You abandon that and say, let's try to change the institutions of power that are in the U.S. state through the party system, you know, which is actually something that was always going on anyway, right? But it was like the radicals were doing it without actually joining the parties. They were doing it through movement building rather than through the DSA, say. Mm-hmm. My question now, as I get to the end of my long ramble, is: do you think that understanding class in terms that are both political and economic would help us get beyond this burnout?
I would hope so. I mean, I think the most ambitious attempt I've seen to reconcile this with actual classical Marxist class analysis, and I don't think it totally succeeds, is E.O. Wright's second to last book, Understanding Class, where he goes through these theories, including some way more worked out theories than what we're talking about here, such as Weber, Tilly, Bourdieu, and sees where they fit with certain things about Marxism, where they don't. I mean, Marx talks about something like opportunity capture in Alienation from Other Workers in the section of the Philosophic and Economic Manuscripts. What he describes is this tendency to be pitted against your other workers in a way that makes you compete against them and hoard things against them, you know, hoard opportunity from them in an unnatural and unhealthy way. But Marx puts that totally within a side effect of the role of production on the class itself, and thus those methods of power being, you know, more important to your own survival and maintaining stability in your job. And that makes perfect sense to me, but when you try to expand that as a theory for how the entire, you know, political economic system works, and then say that this opportunity capture is literally how a bunch of intellectuals are somehow running the entirety of the country kind of as a cabal, is a little odd. James Burnham this theory has not been generally picked up that much academically outside of right-wing circles. It was expanded upon by Sam Francis, who is a guy associated with things like VDare, who used it to explain why racial nationalism was both necessary but doomed in the United States. And you can also see this having influence on neoconservatism, even though Burnham is highly influential on paleoconservatism. His foreign policy views, particularly in the 50s, which were aggressively anti-communist and based off of spreading democracy throughout the world by supporting dictators, became a foundational idea for neoconservatism. So, like, he's one of the only figures on the American right who's important to both the paleoconservative movement and the neoconservative movement. And his importance to the neoconservative movement is basically, we need to be a better, more bloody managerial elite, but we'll make concessions to liberal civil society to do so. And that was, you know, that's actually probably a bigger lasting legacy than his influence on paleoconservatism, which is a little bit more complicated. But it is there, because, like I said, I was told to read him as a paleoconservative. He was also a major influence on Paul Gottfried, who wrote a book called After Liberalism, which is about, you know, Gottfried's view of these managerial elites using diversity as a weapon in the HR room. Now, if this sounds familiar to people, because they hear it in things like The Bellows, there's a reason for it. And it was popular in paleoconservative circles first. Now, again, there are some things about all this that I think you and I can agree aren't completely false. Like, there is a way in which the media narrative in specific is dominated by, you know, a fairly select group of people. But I keep on pointing out, they still work within the purview of what the bourgeoisie allows. And if they really tick off their owners, they'll not just get blacklisted. They'll get blacklisted in a way you'll never hear of. Like,
yeah, you know, back to Gottfried for a moment. What's interesting about his critiques of diversity is that he seems to believe that that all that happens in society is that identity groups compete for the resources, and that what he wants to do is get the federal government or state power out of the way, so that this competition can be won by what he thinks of as the Christian majority. I'm not sure.
Yeah, although Gottfried's critical. Jew.
Yeah, so. I know he's pretty critical of Christianity too, actually. But
right.
But he wants to return to traditional moral values, which he sees as hierarchical. So yeah. He wants to return to local, hierarchical, patriarchal forms of authority.
He basically makes in another book, he makes an analogy to Aristotle's like orders of people and natural slaves, and this, that, and the other. Yeah.
Yeah. So, whereas most of the time, the critiques of diversity in the HR department that you hear about today would be one in which they're saying the claim would be made that the HR department is not creating true equality, but is instead using diversity as a way to discipline workers and hold on to its own power. That's the left-wing version of that diversity critique, right? But so there's like they sound alike, the paleoconservative one and this, I don't know, dirtbag left version, but they're not actually aiming in the same direction at all. They don't the same.
I would say it depends on whether or not you see HR as a coherent identity itself. And that's where, like, I agree with you, because this is where, when people will attack the dirtbag left as being crypto rightist, I'm like, well, you know. Mm-hmm. On a few things, not really. I mean, but yeah, rhymes. But for example, I don't think Chapo would deny it, like, racialization is important in capitalism or something like that. Mm-hmm. But there are people who will use both arguments, who will claim to be leftist, who will switch back and forth.
Mott and Bailey kind of stuff.
Yeah, they'll switch back and forth between the Gottfried version and let's just say the Chapo version. I'm not sure that everyone.
That's not really fair. That's not really fair to Chapo.
But let's say, or the Jimmy Dore version. That is fair, right? Like,
yeah, yeah.
Like, so you have these two articulations. There is a way in which we can see HR departments and capitalists both being very cynical about using diversity to distract from larger social problems and larger problems in capital that may even be disproportionately affecting, racial minorities. But I don't think you can say that's most of what's going on in this ideology. Mike McNair wrote a response to, let me say who he is for our listeners. Mike McNair of the CPGB PCI, the Communist Party of Great Britain Provisional Committee, which is a group by Jack Conrad and a few other people in the UK. They do this paper called The Wiki Worker. It's pretty good. But he responded to Catherine Liu's articulation of this. He didn't read any of this right-wing stuff, I suspect, because he probably is not familiar with this, because it does seem to be largely an American phenomenon. The only British person I know who wrote about it was George Orwell responding to James Burnham directly. Mm-hmm. He notices the way it rhymes with stuff in the New Left in the 60s. And then he points out, though, that if you were to actually take, like, a class-oriented look at these views that are being traced to the management or to the PMC or whatever, you would notice that there's no consistency to who holds it in their class position. So, like, you would find some of these positions at all spectrums of the class divide, which tells you that it's epiphenomenal to culture somehow. And it's not, it might be describing something that people are experiencing, but it can't be truly said to be a motivating class ideology in any way. So
that goes against what, like, someone like Adolf Reed would say.
It does.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and Adolf Reed is actually interesting to me on this point. Adolf Reed has used PMC consistently between the Aaron Wright period and now. In fact, he's the only person in the aughts that I could find using the term.
What about Walter Ben Michaels?
Probably from the same term, because Adolf Reed was using it.
Yeah.
But they,
I don't
also
know if they did or not. I'm just saying, I would suspect him to. But yeah, go ahead.
But what I found interesting about them, Doug, is, like, they define this more limitedly than either Burnham on the managerial side or Ehrenreich. Because when you pin down, because I talked to Pascal Robert about this, when you ask them what they mean by PMC, they mean elite management, so not just anybody who might be a knowledge worker. And they mean people with fiduciary responsibility to clients, which are kind of that. And I admit that is a weird area, where some of those people are technically petite bourgeois and some of those people are technically salary owners, but they have a legally obligated fiduciary responsibility. But that's, those two categories would be like 5% of the population. And when you read Liu or even Ehrenreich, they're talking about something like 35 to 40% of the population, maybe more. Like, so it's
I want to say something off to the side about all this. I recently was reading about it was an essay called The Middle Class, The Modern Middle Class Child and Neurosis, or something like that. Mm-hmm. I was reading about it because I'm trying to figure out, like, how emotions have changed historically. But one of the ideas in this essay from 1946 was that as the nuclear family took hold and families became, and the economy of the family became more urban and more affluent, so you started to develop neurotic children.
So from like the post-war Social Compact forward, so from the 50s forward, right?
Well, this was written in 1946.
Oh, wow. So even earlier than that.
Yeah. And so this was probably looking back a decade or so. But the idea was, you know, that you had family units where the children were wholly reliant upon their parents for their identity and social sense of self. Whether or not they were only children, they didn't have a community of peers. They weren't likely to have as many siblings. They didn't have productive work to give them a sense of identity and self-definition. And so they were more likely to have their personality absorbed by the parents, right? And this was defined as middle class. And this, they were middle class. But I thought to myself, and that maybe this is not entirely true, but it seems to me to be somewhat true, that more and more of the working class comes from that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. Less and less of the working class comes from large extended families where you do productive work for the family as well as for the community as a child.
That ended in the 30s.
Yeah. Right. It was ending and had, you know, was still remembered by 1946.
Right. I mean, and even if you think about proletarian social conditions, those proletarian social conditions would not be common in any urban environment.
Yeah, they were comparing native-born American urban children to immigrant children, workers' children. So, okay. Like, if you're immigrant, like you're Irish immigrant, and you and your wife work in the factory, and some of the time so does your kid, you know, and they come from, you have eight siblings, and in a ghetto, then you have more freedom and more likelihood that you're going to develop an identity outside of the strictly nuclear family kind of
right.
Setting.
Well, so yeah, that like proletariat, like pro kids, like even when I was growing up, my parents had four children, and outside of where I currently live in Utah, even in the 1980s in the United States, we were looked at as weird by most other working families. Like we had at least
too many.
Yeah, by having one child, like, too many, basically. Like, because, you know, the average in our era is, like, 2.5 or something at the time. I mean, so, like, and I don't remember there being a lot of working class families with that many kids. And I would suspect if we were to do a sociological study that we've seen in the 20th century, that probably started off in professional sectors of the working class, the labor aristocracy and petite bourgeois people and like well-off sharecroppers or whatever, and then spread down through the working class over the course of the century. I haven't looked it up, but I suspect that's true.
Well, it's given me like it makes me realize how important it is to distinguish between the kinds of categories of class that Marxists want to use and the way that other fields will use the term class. Like,
yeah,
being middle class doesn't have to do with your relationship to the means of production, even when it does.
Right.
You know, even when in some basic level, material level, it does, because you're being urbanized and you're getting away from subsistence farming, and you're also having fewer participants in the family actually in the workplace. So, you know, all of that is about the relationship to production, but the fundamental social relationship isn't changed. You can be working class in a variety of ways and still be middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this idea of the, I mean, there's a book I have, a little pamphlet I have in front of me called The Wandering of Humanity by Kamat. And it's all about the domestication of the working class.
Mm-hmm.
And how it's being, has been absorbed by capital. And it's, you know, it veers off into paranoia and...
And paranoia and primitivism, but yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right.
But there's like a base truth to it, I think. I mean, mm-hmm. Look even in the developing world about trends around labor, right? Like, mm-hmm. we have more and more urban labor, more and more service labor, because to use very strictly Marxist term, the temptation to use technology to lower socially necessary labor time has de-skilled a large portion of the proletariat, and also meant that it's it's more concentrated and we're raising more and more of it into service areas and things that can't be as easily have parts of it automated to lower socially necessary labor time, you know, and is less directly servicing commodities and more indirectly servicing the, you know, the social reproduction of commodities. And what I think happens with a lot of these like sociology based brand new class theory trends, is that they're glomming onto something real happening socially, but then extrapolating back into class without having a class mechanism to do so. And without usually realizing that they're often pulling from sources that doing exactly what you say, Doug, that they're just seeing the word class and not thinking about how that word is defined completely differently in this study. And when I talk about like working class stuff and like Pew polls and politics, I always try to remind people that I'm hedging based off of trying to do approximate relations of the most likely output of income categories with what we know about production, because no one actually does recording of what people do in production when they do these class surveys. And even most Marxists don't. The only people who I know who really formally tried to work this out are the people around econophysics. I'm particularly thinking of the people who wrote Laws of Chaos, and their names slip my mind right now. Mm-hmm. But they do a lot of modeling of this. And what they show, actually, interestingly, is even if you use income and power relations as proxies, right? And they say they're proxies. What you see is you have a bimodal system where you have one set of laws for higher income people eventually working one way and one set of laws for most other incomes working another, and they don't map the same way. And it's an indication of a bimodal class relationship, that there's one set of class rules and another set of class rules. And they deduce from this that you have mathematical evidence for what Marx is talking about, but that there's such division in the way that manifests on both sides that a lot of people sociologically in their immediate circumstances wouldn't see the truth of it in the way they would 150 years ago.
They won't see themselves as working class.
Right, because working class is always someone else. There's symbolic violence involved in identifying yourself as working class. It's admitting you have certain limitations. It's okay to have pity for the working class. It's okay to even talk about them as part of like the 99%. But if you really, really identify with it, you're saying you don't have all these social access. You're probably less educated. This, that, and the other.
You're not succeeding in your career.
Right. You know, right? Exactly. Mm-hmm. Working class people are manual labor people. They're blue collar people. You know, they're not privileged. And
I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, I just know people who were working class who had ambitions to get education to be skilled working class.
Yeah. Well, yeah. But the thing is,
right. Go ahead.
But I wasn't sold that as being part of the, I mean, I could tell you as a person who came from the manual labor skilled working class into the intellectual labor aristocracy.
Well, I'm not even talking about intellectual, but like, you know, the woman I'm thinking of is kind of my go-to is a woman who worked at the call center with me at Comcast. She wanted to be a mortician.
All right. So you want to go into.
That seems working class. She didn't want to own her own mortuary or whatever. She wanted to work for a funeral home and be highly paid for it. So right. If you want to go to school, get the skills to be able to cut up bodies and stuff them with stuff and put makeup on them or whatever. I mean, and I thought of it as a rather dreary ambition. But she just is thinking about how there would always be business and it was something she could do.
Well, I mean, that makes total sense, but there is a lot of ways where if you come from, I mean, I've tried to explain this to people.
Would she have been middle class in the sociological sense?
Probably.
If she had done that, right.
She'd have gone from lower middle class to middle class. Because also in the American sociological class, the middle class is defined in an obscenely broad way. It is like $30,000 a year to like $300,000 a year in an income bracket. So like she would have been stepping up with, she would have been class mobile. All right. I mean, I'm just thinking about the way my parents, who were both working class, my mom, in both senses of the term, actually, my mom got educated when she was 40. She graduated from college the year I went in. And they made a huge deal about how we were class mobile, that we were taking, you know, steps up the class ladder. But we kind of weren't. Actually, I mean, like, even in terms of income, we didn't get that much better. But we were sold it in a way, as it was. And to be fair, the kinds of jobs that my mom and my stepdad had in the 80s and 90s, that they were getting either paid less and less well, or they just didn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And that was, so that's why they pushed that trend.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't, and when I was a kid, I would have told you that the people who made, you know, $100,000 a year and lived in the nice houses, there's no way in hell those people were working class people, from my perspective, right? But one, I hadn't encountered the actual bourgeoisie yet. I really wouldn't encounter those kind of people until I was extremely well educated and abroad, and then that broke my brain. Actually, you know, I saw the amount of wealth and the amount of power that they had and realized that they had so much that as a pro, I didn't even know they existed. I was so far removed from them because they weren't my boss. And what I find really pernicious about these PMC theories is they focus on the people you can see who might be objectively, their interests might be objectively aligned with the bourgeoisie because they're, you know, they're running businesses that, you know, it would be fair to accuse them of that. But to pretend that they're actually the people running the show and that they really have the wealth of society, it shows that either you haven't seen it, or if you have seen it, you're hiding. Like, you're hiding something. You're hiding who you think is going to win. And one of the things that I find, to go back to Burnham, one of the things I find interesting about Burnham is Burnham doesn't think you can get rid of this class of people. Burnham thinks that you can just pit these different managerial types against each other and pick one kind that's going to be better for society. And someone like...
better in what sense?
Well, he says it in terms of freedom, but he doesn't really define that, right? That we'll live in a more free society if these...
I mean, one of the things about Godfrey is that he calls himself a radical libertarian for tactical reasons. It's like the way that a Nazi is for free speech.
Right.
Right? He's like, you know, I want to get rid of the power of my enemy, this progressive state, which is trying to create egalitarian situations, create social equality. Therefore, I'm a radical libertarian for local power because I'm a deeply committed to hierarchical forms of authority and traditional moral values. Yeah. Which
Gary North and James and Rush Dooney, the Christian Dominionist, also played the same game in the 90s.
I mean, the thing about Godfrey is he doesn't hide anything. You know, he's straightforward, I think, in the way he...
Burnham might be being straightforward because while he's talking about liberty at the end, he also shoots down in his epilogue, which Maddock actually does praise, as like any scientific person would agree with this. you know, high-minded virtue theories of the state, like Dante's. That's the very first, that's the beginning of the modern Machiavellians. And then at the end, he refers to political liberty. But you don't know if he just thinks, like, I'm just putting this gloss on it. I've already told you that all these glosses are fake. Or if he actually believes it. It's really not clear. Mm-hmm.
Well, look, we've been talking about this for about an hour. I want to get to the Parrot Room. I'm going to say right now, in the Parrot Room, we're going to be talking about, as always, tweets and all sorts of garbage. Right now we have so if you're a fan of this podcast, I'm going to put this at the beginning. This is what I do nowadays. You want to tune into the Parrot Room to find out about the psychiatrist who spoke to at Yale about her fantasies of shooting white people and how we as cuck commies are going to try to defend her or not. You'll find out in the Parrot Room. And that's what I'll say here at the end, and I'll put that at the beginning as well. Thanks for watching this Zero Books video. If you enjoyed it, subscribe to this channel and click on the notifications bell so that you'll be alerted whenever we release a new video. You should also consider supporting us on Patreon. Our patrons get access to our Inside Zero Books podcast every week and can get access to the Zero Books book club and help us to continue making online content from the left.